Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms. It's Sunday, September 29th, 2013, and welcome to episode 59 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go,
the RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and even collecting, which we'll talk about in this show. I'm Carrington Vanston, and for this episode, I'm the host, so you can call me the Mac Daddy. I'm joined by my partner in rhyme, Earl Double E Evans. How are you doing, Earl?
I'm good, Carrington. I'm not going to call you that.
You're not going to call me the Mac Daddy? What about the Daddy
I'm
Mac?
Sorry.
No.
I'm just not going to do it.
Oh, that's disappointing.
I'm doing well. And you?
I'm excellent. Absolutely excellent. Cool. Hoping that the show goes well. We're recording a totally different way. We're like, so Earl and I are beginning the change to a new form of production as we're changing the RCR into something slightly different. Keeping all the good stuff from the past, of course, listeners. But today is our first of the new form of recording. So hopefully this is actually being recorded. I guess we'll find out. If you're hearing it, things went well.
Yes. And if you're not, then you don't know that you're not.
Exactly. But we are going to keep essentially with the same format. We're just going to be adding stuff and making subtle changes as we go episode to episode. And like always, we are going to kick things off with a host's topic. And I'm the host, so I get to pick the topic. And what I've decided, Earl, that you and I should talk a little bit about is collecting to have, like to possess, to own, versus collecting to actually use. Now, I'm not a collector. At least I always say that I'm not a collector, even though over the last year and a half, I seem to have amassed a whole bunch of Apple II software somehow. I actually had to move things over to a bunch of different shelves earlier today and yesterday, which got me thinking, how did I get all these boxes of software? I've never wanted to collect, and I don't take a lot of joy in actually just the owning of a thing. I've been a big reader my whole life, but I've never had a ton of books. I've always read them, loved them, and then off they go to used bookshops. And I keep maybe 20 books because that particular edition, like that actual physical volume, means something to me. It was a gift, or where I read it was a big moment or something like that. So I hang on to it because of the association. But even my absolute favorite books just come and go through my hands and it doesn't bug me. Same thing's always been true for retro computing. I have a couple of computers, Apple IIs, because that's what I dig the most. And there's a few pieces of software that I have because the particular box or the particular thing is special to me. But almost everything I have, I just have because I've lined up, I want to play it, and then I'm going to release it into the wild. I don't actually get the whole having to have. But most people seem to approach it differently. Like they take some pleasure, so they're getting something out of the fact that they have these things. I don't mean to the extent that people become stars on that show, Hoarders. I just mean, like, generally, like our listeners, you, most people who have been co-hosts on this show, most people in the retro computing community are able to use that phrase in a way that I seem to not be able to pronounce, and also are able to take joy in the having of things just to have them. Is that something that you enjoy? Like, do you have some things in your collection that you have just to have that you don't actually use them? Or is everything you have utilitarian in some way?
Well, I think it's a continuum, probably. It's not big choice one way or the other. I think most of the things that I've collected were for the purpose of using. Mm-hmm. And inadvertently, because time is limited and your eyes are always bigger than your stomach, as it were. I think
impossible in my case, but yeah. Unless that was anime, maybe then, maybe.
I think that I've collected more than I have the opportunity to use. But let's just say it wasn't on purpose. I didn't buy any retro computers or peripherals or books or anything with the intention of just having them. And when I say any, then I have to backtrack a little bit, which is why I say it's a continuum, because there are a few items that are just plain collectibles. I have the Fortran book that I learned Fortran from in middle school. Mm-hmm. I don't really use that book. I don't open it up and read and, oh, I didn't know that about Fortran. Now, I might at some point, but more it's just for the nostalgia.
Because that particular book is, like, it's that one. It's not the any copy of that book wouldn't be the same to you. It's that particular one is the one that you read.
Yeah, just random Fortran book wouldn't have the same appeal to me. But this particular book is the one that I learned from. And mm-hmm. it kind of kicked off my career in computing. So,
but do you get rid of things when you then use them? Like if you go and pick up, a piece of software or a Model 100 or a particular joystick, once you do finally get around to using it or playing with it or learning from it or reading it or what have you, do you then say, okay, I'm done with that, off it goes, put it up on eBay or give it away, or do you still keep it?
I have in a few cases gotten rid of them. I have to admit I'm not as good at that as I ought to be. For instance, I had a TI-99/4 computer that I had just as a curiosity because I didn't have a chance to play much with it back in the day.
And they're kind of cool. So, I always liked the form factor of that.
Yeah, they're kind of a neat computer. So I got it and I played with it and then I got rid of it.
Right. Okay.
And it was just for the experience of having it for a while. It wasn't a core part of my collection. Even, believe it or not, a couple of Commodore computers that I had not had experience with in the 80s, the Plus 4 and the Commodore 16, I picked up and then sold off because I didn't have a use for them anymore. But mostly the things that I collect tend to stay collected, which is why the amount of space that I need is growing. But, you know, philosophically, I collect to use rather than collect to just have, with, again, the exception of some memorabilia. I've got buttons from various Comdexes that I went to in the 80s and 90s. You can't really use those unless I'm at a computer club meeting. I'm not going to be walking around wearing them over
to
Starbucks.
So you did walk around and wore one. Anybody who approaches you and knows what that button means is someone you want to be friends with.
It is definitely, yeah, it would be a niche sort of qualifier, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's my take on it. And you also mentioned the majority of the folks that we interact with. And of the people that I interact with in the retro computing community, I would say more of them collect to use than collect to have. I do have a couple of friends that have just amazing collections of computing. And I know that there's some of them that just sit in the storage area and don't actually come out unless it's a conversation piece. But that tends to be the exception rather than the rule of the people that I hang out with.
Interesting. Yeah. I guess, you know, now that I think of it, it does seem to be the case that most of the retro computing hobbyists, if I interact with them or if I drop by and visit, it is the case that they'll have their things out. But I know so many people that will have, you know, they've just picked up their ninth Power Mac, you know, 1500 or something. And I'm like, well, why do you need nine of those?
What are you going to do with all
those? How many SC30s do you need? Or like that kind of stuff. Someone says, they basically look like they've got every Bondi Blue Macintosh ever made. Like, why do you need 35 of those? You can't, like, I get the idea that if you really want one, you might then want another for parts eventually or something. Seems weird to have nine of something.
Nine may be too much. There's a third category here, collect to use, collect to have, or collect for spares.
Or collect for investment, I guess, in some case, if you could pick up a cheap Apple One.
Seems to be happening. A friend just gave me three Mac Pluses and a Mac 512.
Well, see, there you go.
And it was free, and so if any of them work, I'm not going to keep three Mac Pluses. So I've tested two of them, and one of them works perfectly. You know, whatever doesn't work perfectly, then that may become parts, but I don't need more than one Mac Plus.
Mm.
In fact, I didn't even know that I was going to need a Mac Plus. It's the first Mac that I played with, though, so I took it. Again, this is one of those situations that, you know, a friend says, hey, saw this at a garage sale. These people were just giving them away. They said if somebody doesn't take them, they're going to take them to Goodwill. And, you know, my brain started melting, and I, no.
Well, that's it, too. Sometimes, like, I'll get something because someone says, oh, I think it's going in the trash if I don't take it. Like, I feel like I'm rescuing it like a kitten. And then I have to, you know, Power Mac or this Mac Plus needs a good home. Like,
if you need
a good home,
it.
I've got a basket of early Mac Pluses. Yeah, absolutely. I have many times had things come into my hands where I think, well, what do I – at the moment, I have spare Apple II stuff. And like, my thinking was, oh, excellent. I can bring it down to Kansas Fest. It will find a home. That can, because, you know, I don't need – I mean, how many Apple IIe's do I need? And the answer is one.
And another part of this spare thing is that not only do I use them, but I want to use them with confidence. When I take them out, if they break, I want to know that either I'm okay with their breaking, that I'm just saying, you know, whatever. If it breaks, then oh well. Or if it's a core part of my collection, I want to have spares so that I'm not nervous when I'm turning it on. I just bought another VT100 keyboard.
Okay,
on
cool.
eBay. I have two VT100s. Both of them work, but I only have one keyboard. My wife is saying, why do you need another keyboard? I thought, well, because I don't have two VT100s. And if I'm using one, and if the magic smoke comes out of the top, I don't want to be sitting there totally nervous that, oh, doggone it, see, I knew I shouldn't have used that often.
So is the mentality, because I do the same thing, though, but then I wonder if the gut mentality there is fear that these things will go away, because you could also just wait till it smokes and then go on eBay and buy one.
But how often do you see a VT100 keyboard on eBay?
Rarely.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
Is that,
yeah, some items, like if I only at the moment had one Apple IIe, I would feel very confident I could pick up another one if mine somehow got destroyed.
Yes.
Yeah.
You might pay some decent money for
sure.
it.
Sure. But there's
days.
Always going to be, there's so many of them, there's always going to
be
one around. Yeah.
And that's why I'm not worried about, for instance, my Commodore 64.
Whereas I leap in, and if I can get sealed software, especially games that I want to play, and it comes up for a decent price, I will leap on it, even if I'm not ready to play it now, because I know at some point I will want to rip it open, angering all the collectors, because I love that first play experience. I am big on ripping open software. I just picked up a sealed copy of an Infocom game, The Witness, and I already had Witness in the big folder version, but I didn't have a sealed one, so, and I have never played it, so I look forward to ripping that one open. Mwah!
Smelling the 80s air.
Exactly. But the anti-collector in me just does love to rip open new stuff. So anyway, I just thought it was interesting because it does seem, yeah. I always feel a little out of step with the industry because everybody else seems to enjoy the having of the things a little more than I do. Like it just, and yet it's not that I want to do everything with emulation. I like to play with the real stuff. I just only have so much time. So I pick just the one or two things and go, that's it for me.
I think, to be honest, Carrington, you've found a better life balance than the rest of us.
Very few people would say that looking at me, but okay. Awesome. I look around my messy condo. Do you really? Doesn't look like I'm balanced. Doesn't look like I'm balanced at all, but okay. Excellent. Well, anyway, that was our host topic. I'd be really interested to hear from our listeners what their take is personally on, do you collect to have? Do you collect only to use? Are you fooling yourself and you collect thinking you're going to use, but you have what now? You are one of the people with the 300 Macintosh 2CIs. You're like, well, what will I do with those except build a house out of them? So are you a user,
awesome,
are you a haver,
cool,
or both? It would be pretty awesome. And then when you need the heat, you just turn them all on. Like, that wall is breathing at me. So let's get to the news. So I believe you have something to share with us about. You just brought up Forth, and I think you've got some Forth news.
Forth, I'll talk about at the end because I'm really falling down the rabbit hole on this. I'm becoming an enthusiast. You know, my mother warned me about things like this.
Your mother warned you about Forth?
Yeah.
You're a very strange mother.
So I had a really short but sweet email conversation with a fellow named Scott Ballantyne.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 80s, he created a version of Forth for the Commodore 64 that's widely regarded as the best, and he gave it away. He had looked at the other Forths that were available, didn't like them, thought, well, the heck with it, I'll create my own.
And I think we talked about Blazing Forth last episode. Yeah.
We did. I mentioned it. So I had taken the documentation, which was an old text kind of scrambled form, and I made a really nice indexed PDF out of it. But I thought, I better not just publish this. I know it's decades away, but, you know, respect. So So I tracked him down and I emailed him and let him know, hey, you know, believe it or not, you're still earning karma points on this software that you gave away. There's still people using it, enjoying it. We're actually doing a classroom series on it at the local Commodore retro meeting. And may I please publish this PDF? And he mailed me back and he thought, wow, it's so exciting. There's people still using this. You brought back a lot of great memories for me and thank you. And yes, with my blessing, please publish that PDF manual. Looks great. So
Very cool.
Yeah, I thought it was fun that I actually had a chance to interact with him. And he's still in the computer world, still doing computer stuff. And anyway, that was cool. So I thought I'd share it. I'm probably going to publish that through the website of the same website where you can have cloud storage for your Commodore disk images. And
We also talked about that last show.
Okay. Yeah, and along with the images that you can freely distribute, because back in the day he said this is for free distribution.
Nice. I like that mentality. I'm a big fan of that.
Yeah, it was gorgeous. So anyway, that was fun.
Very cool. Very cool. Nice. I like it. Good bit to kick us off with. So I am going to bum out the party now, man. I'm going to harsh your mellow with some sad news about the passing of Wayne Green. And when I heard about his passing, I was like, Wayne Green, I know this name. Why do I know this name? Because I'm so enmeshed in the Apple II world, I'll sometimes forget to cast my mental net a little wider. And of course, Mr. Green is very famous for basically founding and running two magazines. The first is 80 Micro, which is the big was the big TRS-80 magazine. So he was the founder and publisher of that, long history with it. And then in 1975, he founded Byte Magazine and ran that for a while. So he was the force behind both 80 Micro and Byte. So this is a guy, like, here we are as podcasters, but this is a guy who put a lot of information out into the world. Like, just crazy what this guy published.
Indeed.
So yeah, so unfortunately he has passed away, and it is unfortunately the case as we get farther and farther into retro computing, the founders of it, the big movers and shakers, we're talking about things that are now 30 and 40 years old, and people are unfortunately getting up there. And,
they're getting up there. Yeah. And Wayne Green did actually, I have to congratulate him on a long life. I believe he lived to 91.
Well done.
And,
well done him. Personal best.
And yes, we should be so lucky. And also, I also have to mention he had amateur radio publications as well.
Oh, yeah, because I think he was big into that even before the computer stuff.
Mm-hmm. I believe 7.3 Magazine was a Wayne Green publication, if I recall correctly.
Don't know that
one. We could Google that real quick, but yeah,
sound a little too professional for us? I'm just going to go out there and say he was absolutely, that was his magazine, 100% guaranteed, and I welcome listener comments.
Yeah, pro or
so con. Much easier than working, Earl.
Yep. You do it. 7.3 Magazine was also his, according to Wikipedia.
Oh, well, then it's got to be true.
If it's on Wikipedia, it's got to be true.
Coincidentally, I just posted that on Wikipedia, so that's a surprise.
So yes, but rest in peace.
It is sad, but rest in peace, absolutely. And you know, thanks for all the great stuff. I read Byte Magazine, and fantastic. So well done him.
Indeed.
So what do we got next?
Well, so Ken Gagne,
I know him.
Apple, we do.
Yeah.
We know Ken, don't
we?
Mover and shaker. He wrote in to let us know about Linotype, the film.
The film, you say?
Yes. And I'm going to read this straight from the website, and then we can chat about it for a second. This is a quote. Linotype, the film, is a feature-length documentary centered around the Linotype typecasting machine. Called the Eighth Wonder of the World by Thomas Edison, it revolutionized printing and society. The film tells the charming and emotional story of the people connected to the Linotype and how it impacted the world. So this isn't exactly retro computing, but it's historically very important, and I actually think there's a link there, because typography actually does have a strong correlation.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, 100%. 100%. Absolutely, yeah.
Especially Steve Jobs' fascination mm-hmm. with typography and how he was insistent that good typography would be integrated into the Apple product line.
And I have my personal retro computing history. Well, my personal computing history that's now retro has a lot to link it to Linotype. Because my family founded and for a lot of years owned a company called Valpak, which is the coupons you get in envelopes. And we haven't had anything. We haven't had that started on my parents' kitchen table. We haven't had anything to do with that company for years and years. But when we did own it, at the time, it was the part in Canada. We were partnered in the States. And in Canada, it was the largest cooperative direct mail company in the country by far. Like just, you know, by put out something like 50 million envelopes a year or something ridiculous. With like just a huge amount of printing.
And you're just full of surprises.
It's weird. It's weird the stuff my family has done. So, and because of that, because it was such, you know, massive quantities of things all printed here in Toronto and then distributed all across the country, it was really short turnaround sometimes. Like things would come in, the art would come in or the offer to make a Chinese food coupon and it would have to be all typed up and created and ready to print within 48 hours. And it was like this, like when stuff comes in within 2 days, it's got to be on the press because 3 days later, it's got to be in Nanaimo, BC getting sorted at the post office, like just crazy fast turnaround. So they were always looking for ways to reduce that turnaround time. And one of the ways we really focused on was in going, when I was a kid, I worked Linotype machines, not the big press type things like would be on here, but the computerized versions where when you would do what's called typesetting and it was paste up. So it in the way that we now use cut and paste in word processors, like I grew up with literally cut and paste. You would type stuff out on a Linotype machine and mm-hmm. you would use little special commands and they would say, okay, I want these words and I want them in this font and this size and this typeface. I want it to be bold and italic and this big and blah, 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 and everything to points. And then it would print out on a piece of film, not looking like the layout. It would just be all the little bits, which would then go to the paste up artist who would use an X-Acto knife and actually cut out the little bits of printed sticky stuff and paste it down on a board that would then be photographed to make the film that would then be used to make a plate. And so there was a particular weekend where we adopted desktop publishing. Like we went Macintosh, desktop publishing, and it was at the launch of the Macintosh 2CX. And we told everybody, okay, on Friday, we're shutting down these machines, and on Monday, we're going to desktop publishing. And so we had everyone come in over the weekend. Wow. You had to learn all the types of people, had to learn all the commands to say, it's going to be WYSIWYG, it's going to be interesting, and we're going to bite the bullet, and here we go. And the entire company just moved over the weekend to this new tech.
Big switch kind of migration.
It was crazy, crazy changes. So, but I remember Lino stuff. I remember having to learn all those commands. I remember printing stuff out and going, that's not what I thought it would look like. So the adoption of WYSIWYG, the what you see is what you get, that whole, I'm looking at a coupon on the screen in Quark, and this is what it will look like when it prints out on a laser printer, was the biggest deal. It was crazy. It just cut like a full day off production. It was a massive change. So I have a personal history with Lino stuff and loving the move to computers, thinking it was like the greatest thing ever. It was one of the big leaps in my personal technology was the moving to computers. So I'm thrilled about this movie and I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, and that's really really exciting personal anecdote too, Carrington. That's fun stuff.
Yeah, it's weird. I remember as a family, we're always like, oh yeah, I remember that Monday where we said, okay, I wonder if this will work or if our company's about to go under.
Could have seen something like that. I wish you could Vulcan mind meld that.
Just come over, we'll touch heads. It'll be awesome. So again, I was working with the big Linotype machine things, but the paste up Linos, like in sure, yeah, and those, oh, hated them. So, yeah.
Well, thank you, Ken, for sending that to us.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll make sure we have a link to that in the show notes. So I'm personally really excited about that film. So that's an awesome.
I'd like to see that film too.
Yeah. Okay, so let's see. Next, I've got something I have no experience with at all. So let's go a different way. The Atari 7800, something I have never owned. But I get really excited when new things get released for old things. I love new hardware for the Apple II, whether it's like the expansion cards, or it's just a new cable connector, or when a new way to hook up a monitor, is anything, any way that brings new hardware for these old machines, whether the computers or gameplay or whatever. I love it. I get so excited. So in this case, it's for something I don't even own. I have no use for this, and it doesn't matter. I'm thrilled and excited about it. There has been the announcement of a Atari 7800 expansion module. So they're calling the XM. Atari 7800, it plugs into that. It gives you more RAM. It gives you additional ports. And it gives you total amount of excitement. Like, it's just, so you get two expansion ports and a bunch of extra RAM. And I'm just really, really, really excited about this. So it's, I learned about it on 8bitcentral.com. It seems to be making the news in the Atari world. And I'm just thrilled about it.
Wow, yeah, this looks like a great module.
And I have no use for it, and it doesn't matter. It makes me want to run out and get a 7800, which I never did because of the form factor. I was such a fan of the original 2600 and its look, and such not a fan of the later Atari sleek black and silver look with the diagonal buttons and stuff. And so the 7800 epitomized that kind of look, the sleek black and stuff, and I never liked it. And so I kept away from it just because of the industrial form factor.
So like the 800XL probably wouldn't have been your favorite.
No, not at all. Whereas the actual 800 is one of my all-time favorite form factors. I've never even had one. I love the look of the Atari 800. I think it's one of the prettiest, one of the nicest looking computers ever. I love the keyboard. I love that little flip-up cartridge port thing. I love the overall shape of it. I think the Atari 800 is one of the most beautiful personal computers ever made. And I think the 800XL looks like a piece of garbage. I hate it.
Interesting.
Yeah, absolutely did not like that form factor. So I kept away from the 7800 because of it. My life has been empty because of my short-sightedness, my small-minded adherence to a personal style. But I'm excited about this. So it's the 7800 expansion module for the Atari 7800 Pro system.
And I also like it when you've got these expansion and various peripherals coming out for the old systems. And it seems like that trend is just increasing, not decreasing. There's all sorts of fun stuff.
Now, I wonder if it's maybe because we podcast about it, because I am at this point in my life much more into retro computing and retro things than I was 5 years ago. I wonder if it's also just that I'm more aware of them. Is it really that there's more stuff, or is it just that we talk about it?
It could be, but I think that a lot of the I think a lot of the stuff that's coming out now is enabled by this burgeoning maker movement and by the cheap and easy availability of microcontrollers and other do-it-yourself electronic stuff that allow people to do the prototyping, and then they can go with some of the inexpensive options for PC board manufacturing, and you could even, I guess, prototype the chassis or some of the pieces with 3D printing now, which wasn't even an option a few years ago. And so I think that this will actually become more prevalent, not less, in the next few years, because there's just so many more ways for a creative person to build a thing than there were before.
Okay, cool. Nice. I think you're right. I think that's well put. Well thought through, mister. like it. So there is over on AtariMuseum.com, there is an XM status page. So because as far as I can tell, this is done but not actually available. Like, there's so much out there at the moment. I just found out about it. So I'm trying to read all these blog posts and all these links. And so as far as I can tell, it's at the point where it's been finished and it's being tested and being shown off, but you can't actually say shut up and take my money yet. So I'll make sure I link to both the post I read about it over on 8-Bit Central, which describes it and its looks and its capabilities. And then I'll make sure we also link over to Atari Museum has a really long page that seems to be updated over time, which is the status page. And it shows, you know, the current status. But as far as I can tell, there's no way for me to actually get one of these yet. So we'll have to wait. Yeah. But I'm excited anyway. I'm really thrilled when new stuff gets announced.
Very nice.
Yeah. So what about you? What have you got to, that could possibly match up to that?
You know, you're always a tough act to follow, but I will say that it's nice that we get feedback from listeners. And in this particular case, we have some audio feedback. We've invited people to do that. And so David sent in his opinion on whether retro computing is a fad. We've got an audio clip to play. And after that, I guess we'll chat a little bit about some of our comments. And I want to thank David for giving us that feedback.
Yeah, absolutely. So here's what David had to say about whether or not retro computing is a fad.
Hi, this is David. And in the last two episodes, you guys talked about, is retro computing a fad? And I had a few thoughts on that. I honestly don't think that it's a fad. I think that it will be around for years to come. There is history buffs that take a interest in both technology and the history of it. And I will tell you that I am from a little bit of the younger generation. I'm in my late 20s. And our idea of retro computing may be a little different than the generation of the host of this podcast. And what I mean by that is when my generation looks back at nostalgic things, we think of things in the 90s, like Game Boys, Segas, maybe even Xbox, and maybe even for fun, a little bit of Windows 95 or a little bit of Windows 98. So as time moves on, what we think of retro computing is going to change. And also, the way that we retro compute. You discussed how the parts are becoming harder and harder to find and how expensive they can become. So what we've done to kind of correct that problem is using software to emulate the hardware. And in that part of the technology world, I have mixed feelings because I've used emulators before for certain projects and for just for fun. And I've either had good experiences or I've had experiences where all I want to do is just use the real hardware. So I think that retro computing is going to change, but I don't think it's ever going to actually die. Just like collecting cars, yes, the cars from the 1920s are harder to find and maintain, but there will always be people there who have an interest in them. And it spans generations because even one of the hosts said how he's been with his daughter showing her the old technology. But I think the way that it's perceived and what is considered nostalgic is going to change. And I'd like to thank you guys for a great podcast, and I appreciate how you both blend the modern and the retro into your show. Farewell, and keep up the good work.
So the first thing that strikes me about what David said, and David, again, thank you so much for sending that. I wish more listeners would send something like that in. That was amazing. Fantastic. Thank you for being our co-host for the show. I also noticed that right away he calls us old. I think that was the intent, but I'm saying, David, you're calling us old.
I don't know. I think we've got to accept the truth.
Okay, maybe. But I also thought it was really interesting, and I'm not sure if I agree, but I think he's at least right in part that, well, first, he's definitely right that as different generations will take different things under their wing as what is retro computing. Like there's, you know, people like me that grew up in the 80s are going to be focused on stuff like the Atari 2600 and the NES, and other people can say, no, retro computing is the PlayStation 1. Retro computing is the original PC. Retro computing is Windows 3.1.
Right.
Versus me, I'm like, what, Windows? That's not retro computing. Anything with more than 7-bit text is newfangled. But I wonder, will it be the case that more and more will be software-oriented, more and more will be through emulation versus through the real goodies, the real hardware?
Well, the real goodies, that's an interesting question. I think I could argue both sides of that. I could say that on the one hand, some of the computers that you and I think of as retro in another few decades will just be gone because they will have failed.
But, well, you'll have collected all of them.
Yeah, or right, yes. But to use.
Right, oh, to but to use, to use. I, these 39 Atari 2600s, they're for use.
They're for use. on the other hand, we've seen a rise also in reproductions.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I, just like I said a few minutes ago, I think the ability to do that kind of thing, to physically fabricate a thing, will get more and more easy. And with that, possibly, I hope, fingers crossed, some modern day reproductions of the existing systems, that they'll be brand stinking new off the assembly line. And they may not be an exact reproduction, but, you know, maybe as close as you can get.
But will it be the case that I, at some point, maybe not me, but like grandchildren, will decide that they want to play with an Apple IIe. So they will pour the goo into their 3D printer, set it for Apple IIe, and they wake up and they have one. And then they get to play with it for a while. And then when they're done, they put it back in the vat and it becomes goo again. So technically you can just 3D print and whatever you'd want. That would be exciting.
That sounds crazy to us, but I got to say that 30 years ago, if you asked me about some of the things we've got now, I would have said, nah, I don't think so.
I also said, who are you, mister?
Yeah, and why are you bothering me?
Why are you asking me about this stuff? Get away from my school. So, yes, there's that. I think this is another example of the continuum you were talking about before, that there's a continuum between use and owning. I think there's also a continuum when it comes to emulation, because there's like the real thing. There's forget it, I'm going software only. Then there's I'm using a reproduction, which is kind of a hardware emulator in a sense. So like, there's all different like shades of gray here.
Right. Well, here's a question for you. The C64 DTV, I don't know if you're familiar with it. But
no, but it's got C64 in it, so I'm already tuning you out.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
You went silent. Skype call dropped. What was that?
I've engaged the Carrington filter. No, but this is a joystick that has an emulated C64 built into it.
Oh, wasn't this the one that Jerry Ellsworth made?
It is. But it's hardware emulated, not software emulated. Mm-hmm. So is it a reproduction, or is it it doesn't look like a Commodore 64.
It should have come with an empty Commodore 64 shell you plug it in, because then you'd feel like you're playing on 64, but it's really just a joystick, and the cable just passes right through the computer.
So, okay, take it one step further. Let's say that I take these guts, and I stick it in a Commodore 64 and somehow hook it up like that. Then it's a reproduction, yes, but if you look inside, it's not a Commodore 64 motherboard. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess what I'm saying is, if I can get the tactile look and feel of something like the new Altair 8800 reproduction, if you pop the top off, it's empty. It's right. Not really an Altair 8800.
But do you care when it's closed?
Sitting on the outside, I wouldn't know it.
Exactly.
You know, I'd get the same tactile kind of look and feel with that.
It's like that thing, I think it was an Asimov story about somebody wanting to get the vote, and they start arguing about like whether or not somebody's human. What does it mean to be human? How much do you have to change yourself before you're no longer human? I remember talking to my nephew once about this, saying, well, if somebody goes and gets their arm cut off, and then we give them a robotic arm, we don't take away the right to vote. But then if they go and get their other arm and their legs cut off and we replace those, they still don't lose the right to vote. They're still a person. But then they get severed, but they stay conscious the whole time, but it's only their head. We give them a robotic body, but it's still just the guy. Do they lose the vote? But then the head gets cut in half, and there's a left half and a right half. Now, those both kept their consciousness, and they both feel like they're the original guy. Is there two votes now, or do they both get half a vote, or do they lose their vote? At what point do we take away rights? Now, they have the other half built as a cyborg thing, because they don't want a floppy head, so they've got a full-size head. But then they get cut in half again, and we replace the original other half of their head. So they're now no longer any original parts at all, but there's been a continuum of consciousness the whole time. They always think they are Bob. At what point do we say, Bob, you don't get to vote anymore? I mean, these aren't things that I have to deal with or my nephew has to deal with, but I bet you at some point somebody has to deal with, if you have wings, do you get to vote? If you're no longer, and if I can make 15 copies of myself who all think they're original, do I now get 15 votes, or do I only get one vote? Like cloning. I mean, these are all things. Same thing with at what point is a reproduction as good as or indistinguishable from the original? Because if I'm playing with the Altair that's not the original Altair, I would enjoy it just as much. Sometimes I wish I could get an Apple II that wasn't real. I'd love a 3D printed one that wasn't all yellowed and was actually perfect. I don't think it would bother me if it wasn't actually from the 80s.
Yeah, well, again, down the sliding slope, you can get a lot closer to the original thing and still have an argument whether it's original. Mm-hmm. For instance, if you've got the original unit and the capacitors blow, as happens all the time. We talked about this on the show before. If I don't have the original capacitors in there from the 80s, but I replace them with modern day equivalents that won't blow sky high when I power it up.
That takes away the fun.
Yeah, no magic smoke anymore. Is that the original computer?
Mm-hmm. And how much of it can you replace before it's no longer an original computer? Is it just the shell? And what if you 3D print the shell and you replace all the keys and they're not your original? I don't know. Like, these are gray areas. Best left to people smarter than me.
I'm definitely in that category. I didn't hear a rebuttal from you, so I must have lost you on Skype again.
There is no rebuttal. I can't possibly rebut that.
Yeah, our Skype's a little flaky here at the moment. But David, thank you very much for the audio clip and for stimulating that discussion.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And speaking of original things and trying to get them to work,
yes,
I came across a really interesting article, I guess, blog post, whatever you call it when it's on the internet, at incentricity.com.
I think haven't read this yet, but you got to tell me whether or not this is going to help me get my spectrums to work.
It's absolutely going to help you. So this fellow wanted to get a BBC Micro, the BBC Micro Model B, but he's in America, and he wants to play with one. I also want to play with one. So this is about what he went through to get it to work in the States. And so the two big issues are power, because you're dealing with something that wants 220 volts and you're only going to give it 110 volts or 160 or whatever, and it wants to be at 50 hertz and you're going to say nope, you're going to suck on power at 60 hertz. And then there's the whole display issue. We're going, it's from a country that wants PAL, that wants a totally different way to display things. And so he now has it working, and this is what it went through, like, so dealing with essentially those two issues, like, how do you tackle the power problem? How do you tackle the display problem? And he was successful, had to use some external bits and things and had to make some cables. But if you are interested in doing that, because this, every once in a while, this has come up and I've thought, I'd love a BBC Micro, but it'd be such a hassle to actually use one.
They're such a gorgeous machine.
I think so too. And things like a ZX Spectrum, like stuff that I would personally love to play with, and I've always just shut that idea down because I don't want to get something that is going to sit on a shelf and I can't actually use it. Well, here's somebody who solved that problem, and I find it very interesting and enticing, and we'll see if maybe this encourages me to do something similar.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have to compare notes because I've got a plus 2A and a plus 3.
Ah, well, there you go.
I want them to work. They were sent to me by a wonderful listener in the UK, and I just have not had the wherewithal to actually make them functional.
Well, now you will wear with all.
I will, and I wear it so well.
Atari brings the computer age home.
Ready?
Bonjour.
Bonjour.
Not quite. Try one more time.
Learn a new language or take your best shot at missile command. With an Atari 400 home computer, there are a world of possibilities. In fact, it could even change your life.
Bonjour, Vladimir. Grand-Pierre. Comment allez-vous?
The Atari 400 home computer. We brought the computer age home.
So, speaking of stuff, and speaking of me, and speaking of stuff that you can buy me, is my segue. It's time for the host's retro computing gift idea, and I always think of it as really secretly what people can buy Carrington. So this week,
I don't think that's a secret.
No. So over on the Evil Mad Scientist site, which I like very much and often has kits and things that really I find enticing, this one caught my eye. It's the 3.5s kit. So people who have tinkered with chips, who have tinkered with kits, probably have come across the 555 timer. And this recreates that. So this is recreating that chip, but in big size. So it's a kit where you're going to build it, and it's actually going to be fairly large, but it is an actual working 555 timer and lets you see, well, what goes into that chip. So it's a great way to learn if you were going to make an integrated circuit. Well, let's build one, but let's build one as a model and build it large size using big resistors and stuff so that somebody could understand what's involved in an IC. And in this case, in a very useful, very common IC. So I just love the idea of this kit.
I wish, Carrington, actually, you would make me stop spending my money.
No, I will not.
You picked just an amazing gift item here.
Isn't this cool?
I love this thing.
Totally. So do you have any personal experience with the 555?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, back in the 70s, working with the TTL chips, a 555 was a great clock source for things like decade counters and hooking up to 7-segment displays. If you needed some sort of a clock that you could tune with resistor and capacitor, then this was your guy.
Me too. Yeah, I have a bunch of experience using one. So I just love this idea. Like, I like the chip. I have experience with it. And I love the idea of building something like this. It's $35, and I think it looks like it's worth every penny. It looks really, really fun.
Yeah. And I never knew what was on the inside. Actually, I've never seen an internal schematic of a 555. So this would be not just fun and look good, but educational.
Yep, I think so too, which I guess is the purpose of the kit. So it's over at evilmadscientist.com. And of course, I will have a link to that not only in our show notes, but also in our online gift guide, which you can find at rcrpodcast.com. And just click on gift guide. You can find this and also everything we have ever selected in past shows as well.
So my daughter and I were just using a precursor to the 555 yesterday. We were doing some electronic experiments, and there's a type of transistor called a PUT, a programmable unijunction transistor. It only allows current to flow through it once the voltage has hit a particular threshold.
Oh, and okay,
So once it hits the threshold, then you can discharge a capacitor through that circuit, and that'll drop the voltage below the threshold, which will shut it off. The capacitor will charge again. It'll discharge again. So you get that oscillation sort of thing. And you pick different values for the resistor and the capacitor in the RC circuit to make it oscillate at whatever frequency you want. But a 555 was kind of a better choice for that, from what I understand, more stable and just a more standardized component than that. But I just thought I looked at this and I was like, oh my gosh, I was just talking about the 555 yesterday, and then you pick this. So,
yep, I did.
Nice choice.
So what about you? Turning to eBay and auctions and other things that people could buy for other people or buy for me, what are you going to select as your auction choice for this time?
So I think people should buy this Macintosh SE that is working and looks good and has 2 disk drives. And I always thought that the Mac SEs with the 2 disk drives were just an interesting looking beast. And the thing that I like about this eBay auction is that it's not starting at a ridiculous price. As I was looking through eBay, as we do, you know, coming up on every show, I noticed that the ripoff artists are really just all over the eBay trying to sell stuff for astronomical crazy money.
Yeah, it is bonkers. It's getting ridiculous.
So, but this seller is doing a good thing selling this SE. It's starting at 99 cents, which is what it's selling for right now. The shipping isn't even unreasonable. I don't know to you, but to me it's $31.
It's $45 to Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, totally reasonable.
Things in a nice shape. It doesn't come with a keyboard and mouse, but an ADB keyboard and mouse are not hard to come by.
No, and even the original ones that ship with the SE, the square mouse and that particular keyboard with the big power button on top, are easy to come by as well. And you're right, it's pretty rare that you see them with the 2 floppies. Usually there's the 1 floppy and then the hard drive. Once I got to the SE, I remember I got an SE for Christmas once, and my sister got a Mac Plus, and the difference was hers had the 2 floppies and mine had the hard drive. Ha ha, Kelly, I got the better one. I was also older. I think I'm about to go off to university or something.
So
I was using it a lot more than her.
Well, and you know the old programmer reset switch thing?
Yes, I love that thing that would stick on the side. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And this
has that too.
Need for it.
So this particular seller doesn't have a huge amount of feedback like some people do. So it looks like an amateur seller with 78 feedback.
That's good. I'd rather.
But 100% positive.
Yeah. See, and then that's good. And it's also somebody who's not just like flipping stuff for crazy money. So I totally agree. I think this is a nice ethical choice. I said, well done you.
So I like it. What have you got for us?
I don't know if I can compete to that, but I am picking something that I think I picked previously. It's one of my all-time favorite games. And it's Wasteland for the Apple II. But this is a special version, and if you didn't look carefully at the photos, you wouldn't realize why you really, really, really want this one. They waste. In fact, I almost didn't choose this because I was going to just bid myself. see, Wasteland, a lot of people, a great, great game. And the version that I have, in fact, I have two copies of it. I got to eventually start giving these things away, is it comes in the thin EA folder. It's so, you know, they came as that little record album size that would fold over and the discs are tucked on the inside. Great game. Amazing game. But the original first release for the Apple II actually came in a box. It was a thicker box, not the little folder. And one of the things you got with the thick original box version, and you never see this, the thick box on eBay, is it came with the Wasteland Survival Guide. That is this, and I have that separately, but it's this, it's a diary as if somebody else played the game ahead of time. A party has gone before you into the game Wasteland, and one of the members of the party kept a diary. They made some maps, and they kept a diary of what they did. It's not really a walkthrough, and they don't do everything right. People die in it. The maps are incomplete and sometimes a little wrong. They didn't find every secret. They don't do things in the smartest order. So it's not like, oh, this is a perfect guide to just make you win.
It's not a giveaway. It's just fun.
It's amazing. Yeah. And once you finish the game, it's incredible to read that. The Wasteland Survival Guide itself usually goes for anywhere from $50 to $100. It's hard to get that. So the fact that this game, currently it's got six bids, there's still a few days left to go, it's at $69, but you can't really get the Wasteland Survival Guide for that. This is a complete copy of the thick box version of Wasteland. I think it's going to go for quite a bit. I was really tempted, but I'm not dropping a couple $100 on a video game. But yeah, you just never see this. So it's quite, and the problem is the photo's taken from like face on, and you can tell from the look of it that it's not the folder version. But if you weren't aware of it, you'd think, oh, this is just another copy of Wasteland. And it's not. It's the good copy of Wasteland.
Very cool.
Yeah. So some lucky person is going to get it, and it won't be me.
And this is why we do what we do. We help to curate these auctions so you don't have to.
Yeah, but people could buy it and give it to me.
They could.
That would still be cool. So, yeah, so those are our choices for this week. So I think that brings us to the closing discussions, of which I'll go first because I have nothing.
Well, I saw you had nothing in the show notes.
I got nothing going on.
I know you got something.
I got nothing. I've had a cold, which I'm still getting over, so I have to apologize for listeners if I sound quite nasal. I can't even hear myself. I thought it was allergies, but I don't know what it is, but my head is just filled with cotton at the moment. So I can't actually even hear myself. I can barely hear you.
you sound like, fine, actually, Karen.
Well, that's my professionalism.
Sorry to hear that you're not feeling well.
And the thing is, I feel great. It's just parts of my head don't. But I don't have any tiredness or aches. So it doesn't feel like a cold, but I've got the symptoms of a cold. So I don't know. Something's going on. So because of that, I've basically been sequestered inside, playing video games. You know, I've been working on a text adventure for the Apple II, and my goal is to have it done by next Kansas Fest. And I think I have now finally a good working text parser where you can type long, full English sentences and it can understand the difference between things. And I finally have that fairly bug tested. So I've worked on that quite a bit. I'm shooting for a 48K target of computer to run on, and I have like 2K left now. I can't do a game with this parser. I need to change the parser and shrink it. So I don't know whether I'll keep this parser and use that as like the advanced parser, or if I'm going to strip it out or something, but I have to shrink the vocabulary and I have to, you know, become a better programmer. So I worked on that a bit. But for the most part, I've sat around, I've ate junk food, I've watched television and movies.
Just trying to get myself better. Yeah,
I've had some Carrington days. It's pretty awesome. So what about you? Have you been more productive than me, Earl? Please tell me one of us is doing something with their life.
I don't know if I've been, well, you know, from a, gosh, just a life standpoint, work's been crazy, crazy busy, but that's a good thing. That means that we're pulling in revenue, and I like revenue.
This is good. Keeps you employed.
Yeah, which is a bonus. So, but from the retro computing standpoint, the folks who listen to my other podcasts are probably going, has Earl just died? Is he ever coming back? And part of it is because I've fallen down this rabbit hole that I mentioned earlier with Forth. Mm-hmm. I'm really getting interested in this language and environment. with Forth.
Time for a new podcast, just about Forth.
Yeah, I've always had a soft spot in my heart for some of these underdog technologies that were fascinating in that they looked at things from a different perspective and could have been, I think, really big. Well, you know, maybe I'm underestimating how big Forth was. It really was big in some circles and for some particular applications. There were criticisms about it that persist to this day, though.
I learned it, but I never used it. I was never once paid to do something in Forth. So it's a language that I learned, knocked off a bunch of things, like in my early days where I was just trying to collect and learn every language. So I learned Forth, made a bunch of stuff, got to the point where I felt like, okay, I can include that on my resume. I am now a Forth coder as well. But never once did something come up where it was in Forth and had to stay that way.
Well, I've actually got a couple friends who did some commercial Forth work a couple of years ago, or a few years ago on firmware, at a firmware level, not like mainstream PC computing or something like that. But and Forth is actually a pretty good choice for embedded systems because it's so efficient. A couple of criticisms that have surfaced as I've been learning this are, one is Forth is a write-only language. Some people say that your code, it's interesting. People have said that about Perl also, which is another language that I really adore. And I have used for,
I love Perl, yeah,
for work and commercial purposes. But one thing that I'm interested in seeing is if I can do anything for real in Forth, like not just learn the language and understand how all the pieces work and get it working on a few platforms, because I'm trying to get it working on the PDP-11, maybe do a port to the Commodore 128. There's a really neat version of Forth that a guy cranked out called M-Forth for the Model 100, the TRS-80 Model 100. And I played a bit with that and found that to be really neat as well.
Cool.
But the real question is, if it's a language and you program stuff in it, can you actually program anything worthwhile? So I've got a couple of ideas for projects. I'm not going to talk about them just yet because I think they might not work out.
Well, it happens. Sure.
So, but I'm going to try them in Forth and see if using this combination of top-down and bottom-up sort of approach that you use with Forth, building words that build sentences, that build paragraphs, that then build your application, it's the way you're supposed to do it, whether or not that's really viable. Or if I was building something for real, would I fall back to a more structured / linear approach,
right,
like a lot of the other languages? So,
well, I guess we will see.
Anyway, that's my deal. I already talked about the classic Macs that I got. One works, one doesn't, of the two that I've tested. Here's a question for the listeners. These things smell like smoke. Ugh. They were obviously in a smoking home. So anybody know how to get that out?
I hate that. I've bought things off eBay sometimes, and you just open the box and right away go, oh, how disappointing.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a non-smoker, so the smell is not pleasant to me.
And also, you really notice it. Like, I've never been a smoker as well, so you just right away, it's so strong for those who aren't acclimatized to it.
Right. And so I'm just curious. Various people have various opinions, and I'd like to hear yours. How do you get the smoke out of a smoked up retro?
Because it's not like you can soak it. It's just like immerse it underwater for a while. So yeah, that's a good question because it does come up quite a bit.
I mean, you could take off you could take it out of the case and do certain things to cleanse the case. But I had a fella who actually works on retro computing from an antique perspective. I just met him a few days ago, and he was telling me how with some of the plastics, from his experience, the smoke settles in, and you can never quite get it out.
Right, it just bonds with it.
Yeah. But that may not be everybody's experience, so just, you know, let me know what you think.
Yeah, I would be interested as well. If somebody's got a tip about that, that would be great to know.
Since RetroBrite has a chemical reaction with the plastics,
because it's getting rid of that layer, I wonder if that would help.
Yeah. So anyway, that's what I got. That's my closing arguments.
Well, cool. Excellent.
Rest our case.
Well, thank you very much for podcasting with me, Earl.
It is always a pleasure.
And for our listeners, we have exciting stuff coming up. Again, we're going to try to keep the changes slow, but we've got exciting things in the works for our eager listeners. And thank you very much for sticking with us through this time of transition. I have been your Mac Daddy, even if Earl doesn't want to call me that. That's it for this show. So to remind everybody, if anything we've talked about has piqued your interest, you're like, what was that thing with the link and the stuff? You can find everything we talked about on our show notes, which are up at rcrpodcast.com. There's a link there to the forum where you can discuss this show. If you've got feedback, that's one way to get to us. If you want to just jump into the discussion, you can also give us feedback via Twitter. You can follow us at We are at RCR Podcast, or you can send us feedback directly. Feedback@rcrpodcast.com is the email address. You could do that to send us an audio recording of yourself, just like David did for the show. Thank you, David. That was awesome.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, but write us, tweet us, feedback us, go on iTunes and give us a minimum of a 1-star review, whatever, just any sort of get into touch. We really appreciate. And meanwhile, in the meantime, while you're being mean, you should remember to, here we go, folks, retro compute. Thanks for listening. Will I ever find my way?